Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes an idea worth spreading? The cultural touchstone known as TED grew out of a 1984 conference focused on technology, entertainment, and design, hence the acronym, and today has evolved into a nonprofit corporation devoted to spreading ideas on everything from science to business to global poverty. There are TED events all over the world these days, with talks logged in different dozens of languages on hundreds of subjects, and adding TED speaker to one's resume is as prestigious in some circles as winning an award. Kelly Stetzel is content director at TED, and part of her job involves traveling all over the world to recruit and audition potential presenters. She's in town for this year's TEDx SMU conference that takes place Saturday, November 1st at City Performance Hall in Dallas. Kelly, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for anyone who's never been to a TED or a TEDx conference before, how would you describe the audience experience?
I mean, so the speakers in the program are from all different fields, usually organized around kind of a central theme. But the talks are different than what you normally hear at conferences. They're really more about kind of one main idea. And so it's people sharing their knowledge on the thing that they do the best, know the most about, spend the most time thinking of, and sharing it in a way that kind of is accessible to everyone, but just infuses you with all kinds of new knowledge. So in a way, as an audience member, you walk out of an event drawing parallels between talks you never thought you would connect, like, you know, the ants networking and the internet and how that works.
I would imagine there are some really interesting conversations in the lobby outside the lecture hall.
Oh, you bet. And a lot of times we put together the programming really thinking about what's coming up before a break so that when you meet people, what you're actually doing is instead of going, hi, I'm Kelly and I work for Acme Corporation, you know, you're actually having a conversation with them about, okay, wow, I just walked out of there and that talk blew my mind and it made me really think about something differently. What was your experience of that? So you start sort of connecting with others on a really deep level. So another kind of interesting piece of the audience experience is that people build these really deep and lasting connections with others that they meet at TED or TEDx events.
So you have to be careful, I would imagine, when there's so much intensity and so much, you know, passion is what you want from everybody. You have to be careful of, like, audience fatigue, right?
Well, you know, people tend to really stay engaged. And part of what we do is build long break times in so that, you know, people are standing up and walking around, but doing exactly what you were just asking about, and that is connecting and really talking about the ideas and, you know, building sort of excitement around them. And sometimes they connect with others who decide to take something they've heard and turn it into some sort of action. So, you know, and it's also part of the reason we have sort of format that keeps the talks short. The longest talk we have at TED is 18 minutes. Many of them are 12, 9. They're not all necessarily multiples of three, but we keep the talks short so that they really convey, you know, information and depth and substance, but that they're you know, short enough that, you know, you get what you need and then you move on to another topic. And we program also sort of with a flow that hopefully counteracts any audience fatigue. So we may insert music after a particularly heavy talk.
So I think it's interesting that the focus really is still on, like, a live human being on a stage. And sometimes for the TEDx conferences, there's a sprinkling of recordings of a live human being on a stage. But In this age where we could do movies and other kinds of fully multimedia presentations, what is it about having a person standing there that still works?
I think people really deeply crave human-to-human connection. And I think that's, you know, that when we're working with speakers to sort of prepare them for their talks, what we're not looking for is a lecture. What we're looking for is something that feels a little bit more like a conversation. It's an intimate room. And we even think about that when we're thinking about theater design. And, you know, we like something where the speaker can look the audience members in the eyes and can, you know, can really sort of connect with people, can maybe walk out on a thrust and sort of, you know, have look at people individually as they make a point so that it really feels a little bit more like a conversation and like direct contact with other people in the room than, you know, oration.
So you don't want a stadium version of TED is what you're saying?
No. Yeah, it's just, I mean, well, there are some large TEDx events that work really well that way, but it's still the way that the speakers think of their talks is a lot more, you know, being authentically themselves, really communicating in the way that they would, like you and I are talking right now.
So there are people who are absolutely brilliant and have amazing cutting edge ideas and aren't necessarily comfortable standing up in front of a group of people and presenting these ideas. What do you do in those situations?
You know, I mean, I think that when people are really passionate about what they do, that that's really important. And then that's something we think about when we select a speaker, that they really know their talk. I mean, they know their material and it has deep substance and that they also really care about it. And then in most cases, when they have those two things, I mean, every talk is different. And when people embrace their inner introvert or inner nerd or whatever, it can become a spectacular talk too. It's not we're not necessarily looking for a polished talk. We want someone to be prepared and to come up and know what they're going to communicate and how they plan to communicate it. But there are so many different styles you see, and you can sometimes tell that people are shy or you know, maybe haven't spoken a lot publicly, but that's also okay. As long as it's authentic and they really care about what they're sharing, then they can communicate it really well.
So the first person I met who had gone to an actual TED conference, as opposed to a TEDx, although those are great too, spoke about it with an almost like religious fervor. People really love these things. On the other hand, the past few years, there have been people who have said this is like, you know, chicken soup for the hipster soul and it's unrealistic. What do you do? Where do you think that disconnect comes from? And are you concerned that there are people who think that something that TED maybe presents an inauthentic picture of some of these ideas that are being discussed?
I mean, I think I don't think that that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, if I know as someone who puts together the programming, we really look into every speaker that we have on the stage and we make sure the science is very solid, very, you know, cutting edge or, you know, significant. And, you know, so I just don't think it's true. I think it's you know, sometimes what we do here is that we're not presenting the full picture. And it's true that with a shorter talk, you are limited, but we're not saying we're presenting the full picture either. You know, we want people to come on the stage and share enough information that, you know, again, that it has substance, but it's not everything. And hopefully people who watch the talks, you know, and get excited by something they hear or disagree with something they hear, then go in and dig deeper and research more on the topic. And we do have the website has evolved recently to a new version where speakers are putting up links and more information and places you can dig a little deeper on some of their topics.
When you first started looking for talent for TED, I would imagine there were some people who didn't really know what the conference was and you had to talk them into it. Was that true and how has that changed?
Oh, yeah, it's changed so much. I've been at TED for 10 years now, a little over 10 years. And so when I started working at TED, there were three of us working out of Chris Anderson, who runs TED, working out of his apartment. And it was a once a year conference. And that was it. There was no online video because of bandwidth restrictions at that time. So it really was a sales job in a way. I had to get on the phone with people and say, here's why you should give up 5 days of your life to come and speak for no money. I promise you it'll be worth it. And, you know, there are, you know, 1,000 really fantastic people in the room. And some people knew what TED was, but it did have a bit of a cult following then, and a lot did not. So then it was a lot more convincing people why they should come and be there. And then it kind of changed to being, you know, easier to get people to come as we started first posting the talks on TED.com in 2006. And that, you know, it had this, there was interest that we didn't expect, and we didn't know that that many people would love watching talks online. So that was really exciting for us to see. And then that, of course, speakers liked the chance to get their ideas out there. And so that was really fun to see, and then easier to convince speakers to come. And then at some point a little more recently, it became, you know, it's now sometimes more challenging to convince people because they say, you know, they'll be excited, but then, you know, oh, you know, I'm not sure I have time to prepare this year and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, speakers sometimes feel like the stakes are so high that they need to, you know, work so hard on it that it feels a little bit daunting.
Are there people pitching you and like hiring PR firms to call you up and say, Kelly, you got to use my person?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We probably get, somewhere from 8,500 to 10,000 speaker recommendations from people every year. We look into everything that comes through. And there's some really incredible ideas. And what becomes challenging for us is actually figuring out how to whittle that down. And, we need to put together a program that has somewhere between 60 and 70 speakers. And, that's all we get. And that program has to be balanced, and it sort of has a theme, and we can only have, X number of speakers on art or on, biology or whatever. So it's kind of, there's a lot of work that goes into putting together a program that really flows well over the period of the conference. And, but yeah, a lot of people are turning us on to stories we didn't know about or sharing, great speaker ideas with us too.
What do you think is the value to bringing together, let's say, 1,000 people who've never met before or maybe have very loose connections and having them exposing themselves to ideas that may seem to have nothing to do with what they do in their everyday lives?
I think people often go in thinking that, when they hear a talk, they think, if you look at a TED program, anybody would say 90% of these, 95% of these, and maybe even 100% have nothing to do with what I do in everyday life. But I think it does a couple of things. One is it helps them be thinkers. It helps you to pull out of, I think it helps me to pull out of my daily, life and the things that I do and really listen to what a lot of other people are doing. And another thing is there's such interesting parallels between so many different fields. And I think really interesting collaborations come out of it. We have a couple of TED fellows. I just always think this is an interesting collaboration, but it's like the kind of thing can happen with anybody. One of them is a tissue engineer, and she grows beating tissue that beats, like cardiac tissue.
Wow.
And another one is an artist who works with electronics and sound, and they've collaborated, which is you would never expect. But that kind of thing and those kinds of connections happen in your brain and happen with other people who are there when you're hearing just all sorts of different topics. I just think it's always so useful to make yourself pull back and listen to lots of things that are important and discuss a lot of issues.
Why the transition from, I guess, a conference organized to make money to something that was a not-for-profit venture?
Well, so when it was a conference to make money, that it was run by the founder was this man, Richard Saul Werman. And so then Chris Anderson, who is my boss, bought it in, 2001. And just it's kind of a difference in personality. And he bought it, had started a nonprofit foundation, and really wanted to turn it into something that was about spreading ideas globally and sharing ideas globally. And so it's really that, it kind of went from being a conference that's for a number of people in a room to being more of a way to share ideas around the world.
We're speaking this hour with Kelly Stetzel. She is content director at TED. TEDx SMU, the conference takes place Saturday, November 1st at City Performance Hall in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, maybe share a TED memory or ask a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Okay, now I don't want to alarm anybody in this room, but it's just come to my attention that the person to your right is a liar. Also, the person to your left is a liar. Also, the person sitting in your very seats is a liar. We're all liars. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to show you what the research says about why we're all liars, how you can become a lie spotter, and why you might want to go the extra mile and go from lie spotting to truth seeking, and ultimately to trust building.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard the intro from Pamela Myers' TED Talk from 2011 on how to spot a liar, one of the most popular TED Talks of all time. We're speaking this hour with an official from TED. Kelly Stetzel is director of content. She's also here for TEDx SMU, which takes place this weekend, and she happens to be an SMU alum, so welcome home.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Is Pamela Myers' talk sort of emblematic of the kind of thing people hear at TED?
Oh, yeah. And what we hear at TED is a big spectrum. But, you just heard the beginning of her talk. And one thing that we encourage TED speakers to do is to start in strong. And that's definitely the kind of thing that you do here at TED. You'll hear someone just hit the talk right at the beginning, and so that the short time that they do have on stage is really packed with important content.
What are the rules about audio visuals and that sort of thing?
I mean, we don't really have a set of rules. We believe there's an exception to pretty much everything. So we really work with speakers to figure out what is best going to support the message that they need to share. So some people do use slides, some people use videos, some people use props. But I think we really think about and help speakers think about what is supporting the words that they're saying. We're not looking for, when people bring up bullet point slides, that's very often for them and supporting them as they think through their talk. And we, speakers really should go in thinking about the audience and what can they do, what everything that they do on the stage should really be in service of the talk that they're delivering. So if there are slides with words on them, they should be really simple and not divide our attention between looking at the speaker and then, trying to read some crazy visual.
What have you learned over 10 years of doing this about what really does work and what doesn't? And I wonder if there are any things that have changed in terms of your assessment of people and whether they will work.
I feel like I'm constantly learning, always learning. What works is passion. Communicating something with passion always works. Humor usually works. Clarity is always important. Things that people sometimes tend to do that don't usually work well are using jargon or buzzwords in their talks. Selling from the stage is always something, and it's really easy if you kind of run an organization to go in and think about, okay, this is what I must say.
This is my big shot. Right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I've got to say this about my organization. But so we encourage speakers instead to think about the audience. What is it that you know that they want to hear from you? And then when you frame it up that way, it might tweak the way you would talk about the work that you do.
Has anyone ever gone rogue and been still talking after 27 minutes? And what do you do?
It hasn't happened in a while. it just doesn't happen. No one's going to go 27 minutes long, and that's for sure. We'd pull them off stage. But the thing is, we really communicate that clearly in advance. This is your time limit. The time limit is a ceiling. It's not a goal. They rehearse. They rehearse with us. We do a content rehearsal a month out over video with the speakers. So we're clear on everything. We have a sense of how long they're likely to run. They don't usually have their talk memorized at that point, but we can give them feedback on where to cut, and it gives us more opportunity. We stay in close touch with them as they develop their talks, but they are their talks, not ours, And but we give them feedback that'll help ensure that they hit their time.
So you have to be aware, and the organization has to be aware at this point, that there is kind of like a bump that comes from giving a TED Talk, right? This is a thing that, you know, 5 years ago, I don't think this is true, but now a lot of the guests we have on the show, if they've done a TED Talk, that's going to be in their official bio or on the jacket of their book. Is that something that adds sort of extra weight to your decision in bringing someone on, knowing that it's a de facto endorsement, whether or not what they have to say is something that sort of TED espouses?
It's, I mean, so we don't ever take a position on it, on mm-hmm. whatever a talk is, you know, and we like a lot of times to have opposing views on something so it can create interesting dialogue. And so it gives people something really to think about, too. But as far as, you know, the weight of having someone on stage, I think it's just hard to go down that road. I mean, we have to really be behind the choice to put someone up there, and that includes making absolutely sure the science is sound and that sort of thing. The way I look at it in putting speakers on the stage is that I think of it as being, you know, really for the room in a way. And if all goes well, then that talk that's developed for the people in the room, which is being filmed in a really beautiful way with people who know what they're doing, then it might have a life online later.
How much do people communicate and how much are you paying attention to sort of real-time social media action during a TED conference?
We have, you know, people that do work on social media, and we put some out there too, and so, you know, occasionally we'll work it in some way to what's happening. But it's a 5-day live program, so a lot of us are pretty focused on just making that part run smoothly.
So what's the difference between TED, which is that 5-day program, and the TEDxes that have sprung up in different parts of the country and now the world?
Yeah, so TEDx is this initiative that has been really so surprising and exciting for us. TED started out as an annual conference. It was, you know, happened once a year in Monterey, California. And we've added on a few events that are TED events. But what happened is we added in a couple of TED events around the world. And as we started to post the talks online and people became aware of TED elsewhere, they would say to us, hey, please, will you come and bring TED to my city? And there are some amazing speakers where I live in Sao Paulo or, you know, in Kenya or, you know, Nairobi or whatever. And we thought, you know, there really is something to this, but we're a small staff and there's no way that we can do this in the way that we'd like to. What if we had a brand within TED that we could share and license to people who don't really push an agenda? You know, they can't have a political agenda or a commercial agenda. People don't, TEDx organizers don't make money off of doing these events. They do this because they passionately believe in sharing ideas. So we started out thinking, wow, I mean, maybe there would be even like 30 people who might like to do this. And it turns out there's this community of people around the world that are just as passionate about sharing ideas as we are. And it's been so exciting to see. And so, you know, now there are these events happening all over the world. There are this weekend, I know of one that's happening in India. There's one happening in New York City. There is, I think on average, there are 10 TEDx events happening somewhere in the world every day. And it's just incredible. These are organized by people who are passionate about sharing ideas, and it's great because, you know, we feel a part of this global, really connected network.
Are there interesting sort of cultural differences? You know, I would imagine a TEDx conference in India is different than one that takes place in Canada.
I mean, there are cultural differences, and so I mean, that's kind of one of the amazing things. They're the speakers within each event are often local, sometimes not, but it's so interesting to really also have local voices bubble up. And, you know, we learn so much by watching how the ideas that people, these organizers, come up with when they organize their events, and then also from their speakers.
Is there an optimism bias, do you think, in TED, if not a political bias of any kind? I mean, do you prefer, does your audience prefer stories that are sort of hopeful?
I mean, you know, we all love stories that are hopeful, but I think also we feel it's really also important, though, to address the hard issues. I mean, not everything is looking great. And but we do also take on the hard issues, and that's definitely an important part of a program.
What are the TED Kids events like?
Amazing. Mm-hmm. The first ever event, actually, with TED and kids happened was TEDx Kids at SMU here in Dallas. That happened, the first one was 6 years ago. And so it was the first time I had ever been involved in anything where kids were a part of this kind of, you know, of it, listening to a TED program. And I cannot even tell you what it was like to see their excitement around ideas. And you can see with a few kids every single time that some of them actually walk out of there changed. And TEDx SMU has gotten amazing notes from people. And we've since started doing TED Youth events as well. And they're incredible. And one thing that's really different from kids and adults as audience members is that I think adults tend to sort of we have a filter that kind of tells us who the best speaker is in a way. And kids typically gravitate toward the thing that they're most interested in. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, makes the youth events especially interesting and impactful, because people may learn and, oh my gosh, I could have a career studying bugs, you know, and watching that happen is just magic.
Tell us a little bit about the process of ordering the day, or if it's a 5-day conference, like deciding where to place everything, because that flow, I would imagine, is a pretty sensitive thing.
It is. I mean, we spend a lot of time thinking that through. And so, you know, as I mentioned a little earlier, like one thing we think about is what we want people to go out talking about, because we really do hope that people have conversations that start off on a deeper level and are not just cocktail chatter. So that's part of it. But also really keeping a pace that works for people, so that, you know, there are not too many talks that are, you know, so heady that it becomes hard to sort of process everything. Yeah. You know, we may add music in between, or something funny, or a little bit lighter, or something if we're going from something that's, you know, very, you know, has you really thinking, we may have a visual talk then after that to sort of change the flow. And we sort of create a narrative arc in a way that lasts over the whole conference, but then also one within each day and one within each session.
Has there ever been someone that you've booked that you thought, well, this will be fine, this will be a solid TED Talk, that has just blown you away in the execution?
Oh, my gosh. There have been many. I mean, you know, one classic example is, you know, the most popular talk on TED.com is Ken Robinson, who talks about schools and creativity. And, you know, his talk has had such impact, and it's had an impact on education. And so many people have watched that talk, and he just delivers it so well with narrative to back up the points that he makes, and the perfect infusion of humor. And
I had a great story recently. I love telling it, of a little girl who was in a drawing lesson. She was six, and she was at the back drawing, and the teacher said, this little girl hardly ever paid attention. And in this drawing lesson, she did. And the teacher was fascinated. She went over to her, and she said, what are you drawing? And the girl said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher said, but nobody knows what God looks like. And the girl said, they will in a minute. Kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative. What we do know is, if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. And the result is that we are educating people out of their creative capacities.
That is just a sample of Ken Robinson's 2006 talk, How Schools Kill Creativity, one of the most popular TED Talks of all time. You can find the entire thing online. Are there like long tail effects to some of these talks? Like, you know, have do you assume that, you know, Ken Robinson has had his day and then suddenly there's a surge of online traffic?
Well, a talk like his, because it is so popular and because it's about a topic that really matters to all of us around the world in education, you know, it's continued to have, you know, a strong number of views over time. You know, so a lot of them that are there at the top of the list get views also because they are at the top of the list.
It's pretty impressive, and it sounds crazy, but in this world where people are watching 6-second videos, that you can sustain people even for a 12 or 15 or 18 minute talk. Have you seen any of that diminish? Do people watch the first 4 minutes and then move on, or do they stay with the whole video?
Some do, but many stay with the whole video. And I think, you know, people have a lot of interesting habits interesting ways that we hear that they watch TED Talks. A lot of times people say, you know, they watch one a day, or every day when they eat a sandwich at their desk, they watch a talk, or they have kind of a ritual that they perform to watch TED Talks. A lot of companies will gather people on Tuesdays at lunch and have TED Talks Tuesdays and things like that. So most people do stay and watch the full talk, and it's really exciting to see that.
And translating these for radio, I know that's not specifically your job, but that format seems to work well also.
Yeah, that's been a really exciting thing to see. The TED Radio Hour is, you know, pulling together sort of a curated set of talks together, which is an interesting thing. We have also playlists on TED.com that you can watch. And I think that's an interesting way to experience it, either, you know, on radio or through a playlist where the talks in some way relate to one another. And you know, it kind of helps you create those connections between ideas.
We're speaking this hour with Kelly Stetzel. She's director of content for TED. The TEDx SMU event happens this Saturday, November 1st at City Performance Hall in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Who was I? Was I who I had been before the crash? Before this road divided my life like the spine of an open book? Was I what had been done to me? Were all of us the results of things done to us? Done for us? The infidelity of a parent or spouse, money inherited. Were we instead our bodies, their inborn endowments and deficits? It seemed that we could be nothing more than genes and experience, but how to tease out the one from the other? As Yeats put that same universal question, oh, body swayed to music, oh, brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance?
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What you just heard was from journalist Joshua Prager's TED Talk last year about the 1990 bus accident that left him a hemiplegic at age 19. We're talking with content director of TED, Kelly Stetzel. TEDx SMU is in town, and the conference takes place this Saturday, November 1st at City Performance Hall in Dallas. I understand there are a few tickets left that have to be purchased by tomorrow. You can find information about that online. There is also, I am told by Kim Cobb over at SMU, a live stream, a video stream, mm-hmm. At TEDx SMU Saturday. You go to TEDxSMU.org and you can type in at 10 o'clock and anybody can see that.
That's right.
What have you learned from doing TED conferences that could help all the poor, sad souls sitting through the worst conferences ever, whether they're like in Minneapolis or Las Vegas? You know, people typically, when people are told they need to attend a conference, they don't get excited about it.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think really part of it is in the speakers getting excited about it, you know, a big part. And that is, you know, really for people who are speaking at conferences to really put the work in and prepare and think about what's the time limit they're giving and how can they best fit in what they want to communicate and sort of share it in the most real way. And then for people who are attending, one thing that I think is really so great about being at a TED conference is that idea we've talked about a little bit, connecting around the ideas we're hearing about. And I think if you're attending a conference, maybe even thinking about those kinds of things you're hearing at the conference as really good conversation starters. And instead of thinking about the breaks as networking times, thinking about them as times to connect with other people.
Do you have to think about people who go every single year so that nothing seems like what they saw before?
I think what we do is we don't want to have ideas that we've also heard before either. I mean, you know, as in putting together the program, I don't want to see something I've seen before. But as far as the overall experience, too, we come back from each conference, and as I think is the tendency for many of us to do in our own work, we come back and we go, okay, that was successful and all, but what can we do better? And we are constantly working to just do a better job with the programming, with the experiences, with the, you know, the details of it for the next year. And so we spend all the rest of the time working on what we can do to make it better, trying new things. The new things we try don't always work, and when they don't, we pull them. But we're really committed to trying new things to just see what we can do to make the experience and the conference better each time that we do it.
Back to that Ken Robinson idea of being okay with potential failure.
Yeah.
So how big is the team that is making decisions about who actually gets on stage and how things will play out?
Well, it's a sort of a tough question to answer because, it's, you know, we draw from a lot of people on the team get involved at different phases. We have, you know, people that help us sort of research these, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 ideas that come in each year. And then, a smaller team of us sort of sit and decide what's going to actually, you know, work on stage. And then a lot of that happens really as sort of conversations with the speakers. It's not like we blast out a lot of invitations. It's kind of we work on that, you know, over a long period of time. There are discussions we have and making sure the content's going to feel like a fit with the upcoming program and that we're going to be able to really create a strong collective set of talks.
So you might actually send out feelers and then say, this is not an absolute guarantee that you're going to be on the lineup. We'd like to talk to you further. Is that right?
Yeah, sometimes we do that. And sometimes we're just looking to connect with people that we know are doing interesting work. And sometimes we'll say, okay, robotics lab, we'd love to come over for a visit and see what's most exciting to you right now. And just sort of develop relationships too. And then another great thing is we have this incredible network of past TED speakers and TED fellows that we love to tap into it too and say, hey, who do you think is the most exciting person working in this field right now? Or they, you know, come to us with ideas as well. So a lot of times we're able to just really develop relationships with people and sort of find out what is most exciting and what issues are important to people in different fields.
We have an email here from Thomas who asks, if a TED Talk has ever been banned from being published on the internet, I'd heard, he writes, that a TED Talk by a noted English biologist was banned because he challenged conventional scientific dogma. Is this true?
Well, we don't ban talks. We choose one talk to post every day. So not every talk that appears at TED gets posted. We post a talk every weekday. So, you know, that's kind of what gets chosen to go on TED.com is what gets chosen to go on TED.com. And there's, you know, we have a limited number of days and so therefore a limited number of talks that we post.
Mm-hmm. What have you ever been surprised by a talk that didn't work that should have? And you don't have to name any names here, but I wonder if maybe that was part of your learning curve.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there when that happens, and it happens, you know, It happens probably every conference, and there are a variety of reasons that that can happen. You know, sometimes, we believe in the person and in the content that they have to share, but sometimes, there may be something that happened as the result of changing something at the last minute, and there was a memorized talk, and so they have a hard time connecting with the audience, or sometimes they, aren't able to go deep enough into something, or I think that that certainly happens, and there are a variety of reasons that it sometimes does.
I don't know if you guys keep an official list of like TED things that have come true, but I know there's at least an unofficial list. Can you talk about some of the early things that have been discussed, things in development maybe that have actually come to fruition?
Let me think about this for a minute.
Somebody said the early Mac was discussed in an early TED Talk.
One laptop per child was early on. We do have a lot of people come and really talk about things early on in their, iteration in their lives. And so what we're really trying to do when we put together a program is get people to come in who are working on something that feels like it may have big impact or create some sort of, new way of thinking about something. We'll see things like that happen a lot of the times. And so sometimes people will come off and show, really amazing piece of technology that we saw at TED. And at the time, it was mind-blowing. I was sitting in the room going, wow, this is incredible to see. And it was Jeff Hahn and his multi-touch interface, which is basically what we use on the iPhone and the iPad now, and it's part of our daily lives. But to see that for the first time was magical. I mean, it really felt like an illusion.
I remember seeing a talk a few years ago, and it was recorded, and I saw it at TEDxSMU about, I don't know if this was the same thing, but some MIT students were working on an interface that you could basically create a touch screen out of anything. You could be at a supermarket,
yeah.
And I'm waiting for that one to come along.
Yeah. That's Pranav Mistry. And they on the video, too, that's a very popular TED Talk as well. He's got it on his skin, dialing the phone. And that's something that his lab at MIT is working on.
When you look out in the audience, can you see what the next big device is going to be based on? I would imagine that a lot of people in your audience are sort of on the cutting edge of things like technology.
I mean, it's hard to know what ultimately takes off, but but it's really interesting to see what people are working on and thinking about what may be next.
Do you have to sort of call other people in the field as you're vetting your potential speakers and say, hey, is this gal really everything she seems to be? And is what she's saying as new as it sounds to us?
Oh, yeah. We feel so lucky to have this incredible community of people who attend the conferences and have spoken at the conferences to sort of vet things through. But I think that's an important part of the research process for us is, figuring out that stuff is indeed as significant as it may seem to us. I can, I love hearing talks on, astrophysics, for example, but I don't know at all enough myself to completely vet an astrophysics speaker. So I, I'm so grateful for the help of other people in, figuring out who's going to be the perfect person to have on stage.
I don't know if this happens everywhere. I know it happens at TEDxSMU. There are opportunities for potential audience members to audition to give a very truncated version of a TED Talk. The ones I've seen have always been very impressive, but I'm wondering if the audition process is like, some people are really strong contenders and other people are, I don't know what those are like. Have you sat in on any of those?
Oh, yeah. So I haven't sat in on any of the ones here in Dallas for TEDxSMU, but we have done this at TED. We actually have an annual thing that we do in New York that's called TED at NYC, and it's an evening event where we'll put 30 speakers on the stage. It's from like 5 o'clock to 10 o'clock at night. We do two sessions. Nobody gives more than a 6-minute talk, and we take huge risks with the content, and it's kind of a really fun night. I think every year that we've done that, someone has made it. Some of those talks have gone straight up onto TED.com. Some of them have made it onto the main stage. But we did the second year that we did that, we decided to make it into a whole thing. And we did events in 14 different countries. and we called it the Worldwide Talent Search. And we, in each country that we went to, we held an event like that. So 20 to 30 speakers, all speaking for 6 minutes or less, and covering different regions of the world. And we ended up with 33 of that year's speakers having come from these talent search events. And so we invited them to come back, be on the main stage, and give, you know, a more in-depth version of whatever it was that they spoke about. And we found some incredible speakers that I don't think we could have found otherwise. Some of them were people that we had on our radar, and it was amazing to get the chance to work with them, you know, first on their home turf a little bit and then again on the main stage. But for example, we found this young boy who at 9 years old, he's a Maasai boy, and his name's Richard Terreri. And at 9 years old, he became responsible for protecting the family's cattle. And he, you know, that meant he had to stay up at night and fend off the lions. And he decided he would rather sleep at night. So he took motorcycle parts and built a security system that he had noticed people, when they walked with flashlights, scared off the lions. Mm. And so he built a security system that sort of mimicked that. And it had 100% accuracy. And he got to sleep through the night.
Well, good for him. And yeah, I guess you wouldn't have found him calling a university or something. Do you have people following you into elevators, giving you their speech?
Yeah, I mean, there a lot of people do have TED Talk ideas, and it's actually really fun to hear what they are, because they're great conversations to have. You know, what's your TED Talk idea? It kind of gets to the heart of what are you as a person all about. And so, you know, it actually leads to really good conversations. You kind of get to know people at a sort of deep level and instantly.
Preview, if you would, TEDx SMU this year.
Oh, TEDx SMU is looking fantastic. We've got TEDx Kids at SMU tomorrow, which is also going to be live streamed. And there are some amazing young people on stage. The next day is the day for adults in the community. We've got a couple people that my parents live here in Dallas, and a couple people that I know that they're especially excited about are there's a guy named Larry Haas, who is from Austin College, and he is a magician and is going to be talking a little bit about the philosophy behind magic. And then my dad's been coaching some of the speakers and working, and he's been really excited about this guy who runs the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Awesome. So it should be a good day. And people can live stream events starting at 10 on Saturday, and they can live stream the kids events. And there are some tickets left. Is that right?
Yes, some tickets left for Saturday Saturday day.
Kelly Stetzel is content director for TED. This year's TEDx SMU conference takes place Saturday, November 1st at City Performance Hall in Dallas. Kelly, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.